We're going to go ahead and get started. First of all, thank you to everyone for coming today to this technical reference briefing for the Water Storage Investment Program. I'm Rachel Belanti. I'm the Acting Executive Officer for the Commission. With me today are Steve Hatchett with CH2M Hill, who will be giving the main presentation. Also with him today is Daria Sumer, who is here to answer questions. We have staff from the State Water Board, Jennifer LeBay in the back, and also staff from the Department of Water Resources, Brandon Amrine and Brooke Jacobs. And from the Commission, we have Chris Orrick and Beth Perkins. So they are all here to help answer your questions today. So I see a lot of familiar faces in the audience, so I'm going to spend just a very, very brief amount of time going over the background on the program. Proposition 1, as many of you know, appropriated $2.7 billion to the California Water Commission for investment in the public benefits of water storage projects. Water storage projects being defined as CalFed surface storage projects, state and local, regional and local surface storage projects, groundwater projects, and reservoir reoperation projects. And that funding can only go to public benefits, which are defined as ecosystem benefits, water quality, flood control, emergency response, and recreation. The commission, or Proposition 1 also directed the commission to create regulations to quantify the public benefits of these projects and define how the commission would select projects. And so that's what the commission has been working on really over the last year and a half. The public process for this started in January of 2015. In 2015, we had a series of outreach meetings, 9 locations across the state. We had commission meetings in locations across the state. And we also had a stakeholder advisory committee, members of whom are here today. And so they all provided input on the initial draft of the regulations. The initial draft of the regulations for the Water Storage Investment Program was put out for public comment in January. We had a 45-day public comment period. And since that time, staff has been working to incorporate public comment, to do additional staff work, and to incorporate additional commission comment. And so I actually get to give a little bit of a different spiel on the timeline for the regulations than I did last week at our 2 technical reference briefings. So one of the handouts today was a timeline, and we have a detailed timeline for the development of the regulation over the next, I guess, 4 months now. I used to get to say 6 months, and then a longer program timeline on the back. So yesterday, well, I'll start with the technical reference document. The technical reference document was put out about a week ago on our website, so you have had maybe a little bit of time to review it, although we certainly don't expect you today to have had time to review it in depth. And then yesterday we posted on our website the Commission's revised draft regulations and all of the additional documents that will be incorporated by reference into the regulations. Also yesterday, the Commission held a teleconference meeting where they directed staff to proceed with starting an official public comment period on those regulations. The timing on this one is a little bit complex. So everything was posted on the Commission's website on Monday. Nothing that was posted on the Commission's website is going to change before the public comment period, but there's a little bit of staff work that needs to be done. And so the official public comment period will be opening this Friday when we put out an official notice, so September 2nd, and it will be lasting approximately 30 days. Right now, we're anticipating the public comment period closing on October 4th. And then another component, which is an appendix to the technical reference, is our climate change modeling. Climate change modeling will be made available to the public on September 9th, and the comment period for that will again close on October 4th. Following that comment period, we will have a commission meeting in October where we'll ask the commission for direction on additional changes. We will have a revised draft of the regulations available in November, and then we anticipate one more 15-day public comment period before the commission hopefully adopts the regulations on December 14th, 2015. So a little bit about the purpose of today's briefing. Our previous public meetings on the Water Storage Investment Program were really focused on broad stakeholder input and developing the program. This meeting is a lot more focused. It's focused on our technical reference document, which provides detailed technical guidance on how to quantify public benefits. And so the anticipated audience for today's meeting is really the technical staff of agencies that will be applying for Water Storage Investment Program funding. We know this has only been out a week, and you may not have had time to review it in detail, and that's fine. This meeting today is really an overview and an opportunity for you to ask questions, and then there's plenty of additional time for review during that formal public comment period. We do also anticipate either later this year or early next year a more in-depth technical workshop that would bring together experts in all of the different resource areas and allow potential applicants one-on-one time with those resource area experts. So that is coming. So comments made today will not be part of the formal public comment period. So if you do want your comments in the administrative record and responded to formally, we would ask that you provide written comments during the formal comment period, which will be September 2nd through October 4th. So I think that's all the background information that you need. So I will turn it over to Steve Hatchett to begin our presentation. Thank you.
Folks, we are web streaming, so if you have a question, once it gets to the chat, you raise your hand, and we'll bring a microphone over to you so that it's captured on the public. Okay.
I'm close enough. There we go. Close enough. Too close. That sounds too close. We're all right? Okay. My presentation is going to have three parts. The first is going to discuss the general context of why this quantification reference document, what is it about the regulation, the statute, and the process that requires quantification. Then I'll spend a bit of time reviewing sort of the structure and a few of the key chapters in the technical reference document. And then finally, I will walk through an example of how the technical reference document directs applicants to go through the process of quantifying physical benefits, monetizing those benefits, comparing to costs, all the way down to calculating the monetized return on investment. All right, so let's start out with a bit of context. So quantification really fits in this technical review portion of the overall evaluation process. I'm not going to talk much about the completeness and eligibility. That was described at the commission meeting 2 weeks ago. But in the technical review, that's the place where commission staff will take a very close look at what applicants prepare in terms of quantifying their benefits and evaluate and score based on that. The evaluation criteria include this return on public investment, and I feel compelled to say that there is a bit of change in terminology relative to this presentation versus what you'll now see in the regulation. We're calling the overall process of evaluation and the scoring to result in the overall return on investment. What we're calling this, what's listed here as return on public investment, a public benefit ratio. But having said that, I'm just going to refer to it as the return on investment or the monetized return on investment from here on, so I don't confuse myself. So that's a major section of the evaluation criteria that will depend critically on the quantification and the quality of the documentation supporting the quantification that applicants provide. But quantification is also used to support really all of the other criteria in addition. Certainly the relative environmental value evaluation that the State Water Board and Department of Fish and Wildlife do will depend critically on the information on quantified physical changes that are provided. And similarly for the other evaluation criteria. All right, so this return on public investment that we're talking about today is a calculation, and it's based on the quantified public benefits that we'll talk about today, expressed as a ratio with the funding request. So it's like a benefit cost ratio in that sense. The potential benefits of storage, I think you're all familiar with the public benefits that can be eligible for public funding. Those are the five that are listed in statute and in the regulation. In addition, every project that we expect to come forward will have other non-public benefits because the state can only pay for half, so you have to have other beneficiaries to pay for the other half. And so water supply is expected in most, if not all, cases to be the major non-public benefit. Hydropower is likely to be a benefit that some projects also claim. And we also expect those to be quantified so that the overall mix of benefits can be compared to costs and costs allocated fairly among those benefits in order to determine the eligible state funding for the public benefits. So why do we quantify? Well, of course, the statute directs the commission to develop the regulation that we've just put out in draft form, which is a regulation on how to quantify and manage public benefits. In addition, this particular provision describes the return on public investment based as measured by the magnitude. So magnitude means a quantity, a quantified amount. In addition to simply the magnitude of physical benefits, there are a number of places in the statute and therefore in the regulation that really lead you to understand why monetizing is required, or at least some way of expressing all benefit categories in a consistent unit so that they can be compared against each other and compared directly to costs. And the way this is always done in a feasibility study is by monetizing benefits, and that's the approach we have taken here. Well, you may ask, well, can't we express most, if not all, of the physical benefits in a common unit like water flow or water released from a storage facility? And in a limited sense, the answer to that is yes, you can express many, if not all. Recreation is a good example of a benefit category that can't really be measured in any reasonable way based only on water measurement. But really more importantly, Even those like water supply and in-stream flow for ecosystem purposes, those, in addition, the physical quantity isn't enough to describe the actual value of that resource to providing the benefit. You need to know when it's provided, where it's provided, or the operational rules in which it's provided. So you're still left with somehow needing to create a common unit that encapsulates all of that information into one value, if you will. So that's really the context for why we've developed this fairly thick, as I'm sure you would agree, reference document on ways to quantify both physically and monetarily. Okay, so we talk a lot about the benefit framework, quantification framework, and it's really a framework that is familiar to anyone who has worked on an environmental impact analysis or a feasibility study. It really is describing quantitatively the future without your project, and then doing the same thing for the future with your project, and characterizing the differences in a quantitative way, and then converting those into a common unit of monetary value and comparing to the costs. And that's the process by which you justify sort of the overall economic feasibility of a project and by which you would calculate this return on public investment. All right, so just graphically, what does this mean? So any project is going to have an extended useful life. It may range from as little as 30 years all the way to 100 years in, potentially. So we want to characterize how the project performs physically and monetarily over that period of time. So first, we look at, well, what are, and this is an example resource condition, physical metric. What is that physical condition going to do without our project? Again, in this example, it deteriorates over time without the project. With the project, it's better. It's still not improving in an absolute sense, but it's a lot better than without the project. So that if we take these changes now, the changes between the with and without are, of course, the physical benefits. Now, I'm going to pause here and say most of my discussion, I'm talking about benefits because those are the categories are described as benefit categories, but this applies equally to impacts of your project. So any negative change caused by your project by comparing the with versus without project is an impact, and to the extent that impact is not counted as mitigation costs in your project costs, you need also to quantify that so that you can calculate the net benefit, net of impacts. All right, now the same example project here, notice that the on the left side, the axis has changed to net benefits, so it's been monetized. And now instead of showing the absolute values, we're showing that change over time, which is the increment. And I'll discuss this more later, but then for the points in time at which applicants are asked to monetize benefits, both physically quantify and monetize, we're asking them to do that monetized estimation at two points in time, and they're shown here, 2030 and 2070, and then to interpolate or extrapolate for the exact planning horizon for their particular project. I'll talk more about that. We understand that estimating physical benefits and monetizing them is a very complex process. It's especially complex in California, maybe more so than or as complex as anywhere in the world because of the highly constrained system. We have a highly developed system. Everything relates to almost everything else. It's interconnected and regulated, strict system of water rights, et cetera. So in order to characterize and quantify physical changes, applicants will need to approach this in an integrated fashion as illustrated in this diagram. The operations needs to connect to the physical changes in the streams and in the delta, and that needs to relate to water quality changes and ecosystem changes, et cetera. And that complexity, if you layer onto that, top of that, the fact that most of those categories of analysis can have more than one way of approaching it, depending on what is most appropriate for a particular project, hence the size of this technical reference document. So let's talk about the document a bit. Again, this is a complex process. The document covers in virtually every category, every one that comes to mind right now, a range of methods that could be used to analyze the physical and the economic or monetary benefit. We expect that applicants They certainly can use these methods, but this document, even as large as it is, can't encompass the entire world of possible methods to quantify benefits. So with appropriate documentation and justification, applicants can also use other methods than the ones that are listed here, that are described in this document. So the document is intended to help provide a lot of guidance on models. What are the pros and cons of different approaches? What are the metrics that you can expect to get out of different models, and how do those support the quantification process that you need? The technical reference will also be used as a guide in the technical review process to assess how applicants have implemented the models that are in here. I don't remember if Rachel mentioned it, but this technical reference is incorporated by reference into the regulations. So that means technically this document is part of the regulations. And so as you're responding and commenting on the regulation itself during the public comment period, you can and should also review and comment on the technical reference. All right, another feature of the descriptions of models has to do with appropriate level of analysis, and that's in some cases a difficult to define in the abstract. So the way we've defined it is to depending on sort of the scope of the analysis that you need to do and the importance of a particular topic for your purposes of your quantifying benefits, to select the appropriate analysis. So if you're analyzing, let's say the water flow throughout the entire system from your project through the river into the delta, you're going to need a fairly high level of analysis that would be required for something like that. If you have a small project that's relatively, I'm going to be careful with the words here, relatively small in relation to the overall flows and hydrology into rivers and deltas, you might be able to select a lower level of analysis. But certainly large multipurpose surface storage projects are going to be needing to do a full analysis. So the technical reference is organized in a way very much associated with the overall framework. In other words, starting out with defining the without project conditions, it includes then moves on to with project, then the physical changes, and that's a very long chapter, which I'll talk about the physical changes, and that's broken out by some of the key resource analysis categories and by the five public and two non-public benefit categories. Then it steps through monetizing costs and monetizing benefits, estimating and comparing to costs, et cetera. And then it has a final, next to last chapter, evaluating sources of uncertainty, which describes the there's a requirement to analyze climate change. If you've reviewed the regulation, you'll know there is a requirement to analyze the effect of climate change uncertainty on how your project performs. But in this chapter, there's also a list of other items that you applicants should consider could affect the way that their project performs, what we're calling the resiliency of the project. And those include things like regulatory conditions, future resource conditions unrelated to your project, economic conditions. All right, so I'm going to highlight a few of the sections here. So section two is the without project conditions. And we talk about a number of things in here, so defining the study area, how to define your planning horizon and what that means. An extensive list of operational rules that are derived from coordinated operating agreements and water rights requirements and regulatory and biological opinion requirements, et cetera, all of the many, many things that affect how a project has to be managed in the California water system. There's a section with a subsection in section 2 on the relationship to CEQA analysis and your feasibility study. We had a question at an earlier meeting as to whether we're actually requiring two sets of feasibility studies for, let's say, for a federal participation project that would be preparing their own feasibility study, and the answer to that is no. We don't want you to prepare an entirely separate feasibility study for purposes of this application, but what we do want is for you to describe, why if there are differences, why those differences exist. And the simple example of a difference is we're requiring a 3.5% discount rate. Federal discount rate is slightly different than that. But there may be other differences that you just need to describe as part of your application. Don't give us two sets of feasibility studies, one for us and one for Reclamation. All right. So section 2 also includes sort of the introductory portion of the climate change and sea level rise information. There is an appendix A in the technical reference that has much more information, but it's introduced in section 2 in terms of what you'll be required to do for analyzing your project in the context of climate change and sea level rise. I'll skip over section 3, which is the WITH project, because that really is. It's some basic information on how you go about, selecting your model and so forth. But section 4 is really where the guts of the analytical process is described, at least on a physical basis. So it starts out with some general concepts of, possible data sources, where to get and how to develop appropriate hydrologic inputs for your analysis. How you can describe hydrologic variability by water year types or other means. And it talks about model integration, how you remember that diagram I showed you, how you get models that can fit well together and you're moving information appropriately between them. But then the bulk of this chapter really focuses on the specific sets of models, and it starts out with a list operations models, river and delta hydrodynamic models, and it moves into the 5 public categories. And within each of those, there's some different models or methods. Model simply being sort of a formalized, recognized model package that you can pick up and use. Methods are generally also models, but they may be a little more customized for your purposes. All right, section 5, sort of following on to section 4, takes the same approach but focuses on monetizing the benefits. Whoops. So it talks about some general concepts, including discounting and the discount rate, how to index prices and costs that may be a couple of years old from a study that you're relying on, how to index those up to the common year that you're using. Again, describes data sources and for economic or monetizing purposes, how you want to characterize hydrologic variability. And then it talks about 3 approaches to monetizing. And these are avoided cost, alternative cost, and a very broad category that we're just calling willingness to pay. Avoided cost is a cost that you expect will occur in the future, but you can either avoid it or reduce it or delay it because of your project. The example that we always use for an avoided cost is flood damage. So without your project, you can, through hydrologic analysis, make a prediction of expected flood damage from different kinds of events out into the future. With your project, you can avoid most of those if your project is designed to do that. So that's an avoided cost. Alternative cost is similar, but it's not necessarily, it's not something that you would plan to happen out in the future without your project. So an alternative cost would simply be, what other way can you use to generate the benefit or benefits that you're claiming other than your project? And then if there are more than one of those, you want to select the lowest cost of those. So it's technically the alternative cost is the least cost alternative that can provide the same or potentially greater level of benefit or benefits to your project. And that's a very useful one because it can be it can give you a way to assess benefits when this third category, willingness to pay, you may not have any good information or good studies to do that. So alternative cost is an important part of the toolbox for monetizing benefits. So willingness to pay, again, I said it's a broad category. It includes everything from benefits that can be bought and sold in the marketplace, and you can observe a price for those. It can be those that you can infer a value based on observing how people behave. For example, if people visit a recreation area, they have to spend money to get there. So a common way to estimate the benefit of a recreation site is what's called a travel cost method. That's looking at what people spend and the surplus that's left over and above what they spend to get there is your estimate of the net benefit. And then willingness to pay also encompasses non-use values. So non-use values are legitimate values that people place on the existence or the option of being able to enjoy a resource at some future point in time, either for themselves or for future generations. And because people don't make observable behavioral actions to tell us what that value is, we generally rely on survey kinds of information to estimate what the non-use value is. And there, that's a fairly big subcategory in resource economics, is estimating the non-use values using various kinds of survey approaches. And we talk about, there's actually a fairly good description of a number of those studies related to salmonids that's in here. And I should say, Section 5 also has appendices related. I think there are four, if not five, appendices that are fairly detailed in some cases. One directly relates to estimating ecosystem benefits. All right, so that gives you kind of an overview of how the technical reference document is organized. Let me move on to, I'll go through an example here and walk through. So this is, just for example purposes, a surface storage project that has one non-public benefit, water supply, and two public benefits, ecosystem and recreation. And for purposes of analysis, this project is going to go online in 2021. All right, so let's step through the framework and how it fits into this example. So first, we want to define without project future conditions. So you have some affected study area for your project, and this would be existing conditions. Then you'd need to describe it at the two future points in time, 2030, and you'll see that. Let me back up one. So we're just creating some changes here that just to illustrate that without your project, things are going to change out into the future, and your analysis needs to account for that. So with 2030, maybe the snowpack has reduced a bit, the city has grown, and more of the same. And in this case, we're showing that there's a flood on this river. So what you want to do is take that information about future conditions, and now you need to quantify it. So my quantified numbers, I'm only going to use 2030, even though you would be doing it at both 2030 and 2070. So for our three benefit categories, we have some example numbers for the without project conditions. I'll show you a similar table once we do the same thing for with project conditions. So now we have at 2030 and then 2070, you can see at some point the dam is fully constructed and operating, and there's in this case some ecosystem restoration also. So just an example. Okay, so now you'd have to do the same thing to quantify those same three benefit categories. Again, I say benefit, but also impacts. And let me stop here and say that there is a lot of possibly and likely complicated analysis that goes into generating these numbers. So it's a simple table, but a lot has to happen in order to come up with a well-justified quantification that leads to these kinds of numbers. For example, in the non-public water supply, you're going to have an operations model to assess how much additional water supply will be provided. You'll need to characterize that by hydrologic variability, most likely, and we show one number here, with project 400,000 acre feet, but you would really want to characterize that over a range of hydrologic conditions, probably by year type. That's a common way that it's done, but you get the idea. And then similarly for the other benefit categories, you want to characterize it maybe by water year type isn't relevant for some of the recreation items, but there will be other timing or variable things that affect the way that these benefits play out over time, and you'll want to include that in your analysis. So now, very simply, the physical changes, whether they're benefits or impacts, are the difference. And just by subtraction of the previous table, we've got the benefits that we'll now proceed to monetize. In this simple example, I'm going to assume that we're monetizing in a very straightforward way. We've got a physical change, and we've got a justified unit value per item that's changed, per unit of physical change, and the multiplication gives you the total benefit. All right, so let's pull some example numbers here. I'm not saying that water in this case is worth, in this example, it's $250 per acre foot. We have information that we've provided in addition to models that applicants can use on unit values of water supply in different parts of the Central Valley. If you're providing water supply to somewhere else, you can use a different method. There are other methods in here that allow you to do that. And it's not just by area of the Central Valley, but also by water year type. And I've just pulled a representative value of $250 here. For ecosystem, again, we've provided quite a bit of information on salmonids, the values that are inferred based on non-use studies. That's where these numbers came from, and if you when you have a chance to read both the chapter 5, section 5, and the associated appendix on ecosystem, you'll see how these numbers were derived. Obviously, it makes a very big difference to people who are responding to these surveys if you tell them that it's a threatened or endangered species, which is the case for winter run, versus a non-listed species, which in this case is fall run. All right, now I'm going to sort of go back to this time trend analysis, and we'll see that you would take your analysis. So we showed it in a table for 2030. Applicant would do the same thing at 2070, and then would place those two values for purposes of creating a time trend of monetized value. So you'll see on here the 2030, 2070. Oops, let me go back. The as I mentioned before, so with those two points in time, that allows you to do a very simple linear trend and extrapolate or interpolate as needed to fill out all of the values for the entire planning horizon. Excuse me. It is allowed if there are other reasons to do something other than a simple linear trend. For example, if there's a point between 2030 and the end of your project at which something that you can document, you know, changes in a major way to cause you to, you know, bump or change the trajectory there, so long as you justify it and the technical reviewers, you know, accept your justification, that's okay. But you're also allowed to just do a simple linear trend if that's what you want to do. Oops. All right. Well, the reason we do that interpolation is so we can lay out the entire set sequence of benefits over the time horizon, the planning horizon of your project. And then that allows a calculation of present value of benefits. So now we're getting close to the point where we can compare a number, or a set of numbers, to the costs, and the capital costs in particular, that can be eligible for state funding. Remember, that's the end point here. That's what we're trying to figure out. What can we justify for state funding? All right. So in order to do that, let's just suppose the costs of your project is $1 billion in capital and 1.145 total, including future O&M and replacement costs, so all-in costs. Well, one important metric of feasibility of a project, and remember that the commission has to make a finding, is it a finding or a determination, I can't remember which word it is, that the project is feasible. So I'm not going to go into all of the tests of feasibility. I think most of you probably, you know, are familiar with those, but certainly one key test is economic feasibility. Do the benefits exceed the costs, or is the benefit-cost ratio greater than one? So at this point, we can do that based on the information that we've calculated for this example project. And this is total benefits versus total costs. We're also going to do this kind of thing in a narrower sense by comparing only the public benefits to the eligible state funding. But this is everything all in. And we see that in this, with the numbers that I created, yes, you have a feasible project. All right, now let's figure out, of those total benefits and total costs, what is the eligible amount of those public benefits for purposes of state funding. And the step we have to go through is we have to convert benefits and relate them to the costs. And that process is called cost allocation. So in general, cost allocation simply means looking at all of the benefits of your project and figuring out what is the appropriate and, I will say, fair way to allocate those to the different categories that will be paying for those costs. The example I'm running through here, I'm not going to go into the details of specific and separable costs, because those are important, but we're just going to assume everything is going to be proportional, so benefits proportional to allocated proportion to costs. So we have three benefits in our example: water supply, ecosystem, and recreation. And these are the numbers from the table. I've rounded them off to make them easier to read. And so then those get allocated, again, in a simple proportionate way. If for this example, I'm not saying you should allocate in a simple proportional way. You really, and it's described in the technical reference, you do need to consider things like specific costs. If there's a portion of your capital cost that is only there because you have a particular benefit category. Let's say boat ramps. You're only putting the boat ramps in because you have recreation. You're going to do recreation. You're not going to allocate part of the cost of boat ramps to hydropower or ecosystem. But having said that, in this simple case, we're just going to do the easy proportionate. We're almost done. And in addition to that, remember now we have these 50% rules that are in statute. So of the total cost, no more than 50% of the capital cost can be funded by the program. And within that amount, at least 50% of that has to be for ecosystem benefits. So those are some tests that we're going to apply at the end when we get here. So now we've got our, you know, monetized return on investment calculation, and you see it's quite a bit narrower than the overall benefit cost ratio, which I showed you earlier. So we have, in this case, just the public benefits compared to the funding request. And based on the numbers we've developed all of the numbers we need to do that, and this is the calculation. Really, everything that I've done from the point of quantifying the benefits physically and then monetarily, those can use relatively complex models if you need to do it that way. But everything since then is kind of spreadsheet work. Nothing particularly complicated. And so this is, you know, this is the process that you would go through to come down to a final justified amount. In this case, it's $476 million. It's still up to the commission as to whether, based on their overall assessment of all of the projects and the funding available, as to exactly how much the commission feels it wants to allocate to any particular project. But in terms of just the raw calculations, this is $476 is the eligible amount here. So with that, that's my presentation. I think we now stop and take whatever questions you might have.
Before we get started, I just want to restate something Rachel said at the beginning. We're not in a formal comment period. That's going to be starting real soon. But the questions you ask today, staff is taking detailed notes, and we're going to put together a document that has questions and answers from all three of the briefings, and they'll be available in the near future. So any questions that we have for Steve or Rachel or any of our other consultants?
Nope, sorry.
I had a question where you were showing some benefits that were occurring associated with the project before it became operational. What might those be?
I can't remember which graph, but I can answer that by, well, suppose your project, okay, you're gonna make these quantification estimates, you're modeling at those two points in time, because those are the points in time at which staff is providing climate information, sea level information, and some modeling results. But your project doesn't start by 2030. Let's say it starts at 2032. You would nevertheless make your estimate as if your project were up and running at 2030. But then when you actually lay it out over your project horizon, you do the interpolation and go up, you know, click up to, and you start it there.
In the current, today, 2015, that there was a difference in the the project benefits.
Oh, so you're talking about if your project started before 2030?
Steve, you had a graph on there.
Yeah, let me find
points, the red and the blue points.
Oh, the early graph. Okay, yeah. So you're not required from purposes of monetizing your benefits to do an existing condition analysis. If you have the information and choose to do it, I think that would be great. But for monetizing, that's not required. All we require is those two points, and then you can extrapolate linearly backwards to get to a starting point of, let's say, 2025 or something.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm wondering why you didn't choose to do a basic flow equation based on temperature, time, and climate conditions or weather year? I'm a little confused by the fish thing.
I'm not sure what you're, all I showed you were kind of the end products of a what could be a very complicated analysis that could include exactly what you just described.
Okay. And then the second thing, I wanted to go back to the cost allocation.
Yes.
And you had three costs for water quality, ecosystem, and recreation. But then in the next slide, you combined water quality and ecosystem to create the ecosystem benefits, on which, if you want to go back to the slide, we can take a look at that.
I'm not sure what we're... You're thinking maybe of this slide?
So go to the one before that.
Okay.
So you have it. You have the public benefits divided into three categories.
Yeah, this is a generic slide that actually has four benefits, but for our example, we didn't have all four benefits. We just had the three.
So when you go to the next one and don't show water quality, you're saying because water quality never existed?
In our simple example, we just didn't. I mean, I could have created a water quality. Remember, this is just an example.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Just a little confusing. Okay. And then finally, when you're using the two-point linear computation, how do you actually calculate extreme weather years? So how is drought and the ability of the project to help with water supply or conditions
good,
in drought?
Good question. So each of those numbers in the tables that were then generated that were then put into that linear linear time trend again had a lot of underlying information. So generally what you would want to characterize each of those simple numbers that were in the table in a way that that displays the variation over hydrologic condition. So like the number was, I think it was 200,000 acre feet for water supply. What you would actually do is quantify what that number is over, either an entire time sequence or by year type. Let's say you do it by year type. And so it might be, might be 320,000 in, above normal years and but down to 50,000 at a critical year, or depending on how you operate your project, that could be flipped, you're capturing that, this is part of the issue of trying to display something simply when it's really complex underneath. But at some point you have to average to get everything added to add up to, at the end. But you're not averaging before you, my recommendation, you wouldn't average before you place the value on it, either physically for purposes of the REV assessment or monetarily for purposes of calculating this return on investment. You want to keep all of that variability, not just in the physical change, but also the monetized value of it. And I apologize because we're trying to keep it simple here. Yeah.
Well, just to continue on that for another minute.
Sure.
In Appendix A, the climate change integration, or actually it's uncertainty, so it includes other uncertainties. Mm-hmm. The appendix reads that projects that perform well over a range of future conditions, as demonstrated by the sensitivity analysis, are more resilient. My question is, to what extent will the sensitivity analysis actually be used by the Commission in the valuation of projects? It's not a required calculation. It is still in a separate part of the regulations where it's qualitative and potentially optional. So if this is a linchpin of understanding how resilient projects are, what is the requirement for actually doing a quantitative analysis and using it in evaluation?
I'll start and then maybe Rachel will chime in. There is a you're referring to the resiliency piece of the overall evaluation criteria. So let me back up and say for the basic quantification analysis that's going to feed everything, including all of the stuff that I just talked about, climate, there is a climate and sea level scenario points in time, 2030 and 2070, that are being finished right now and will be provided. So those are a requirement. But your question then is, beyond that, there's a lot of uncertainty around all of that information, and how is that going to be used? It's going to be used as part, as you said, of the resiliency criterion, evaluation criterion. Now, we're not requiring that they do an entire, an entire quantitative analysis at, you know, dry, wet, warm, et cetera. We're just requiring the, because, you know, the commission is cognizant of the amount of work that it required to do that kind of multiple model runs. So what we have is, you know, the requirement for the basic climate change scenarios, and then an assessment that could be qualitative, as you said, of how different, more stressful climate conditions would affect their project, how their project would perform under those different conditions. And that's a requirement that they do that, but it's not quantitative, not a quantitative analysis requirement. If they want to do that quantitatively, I think that would be, you know, viewed favorably.
But there won't be any, the commission won't be providing any guidance on that.
On what?
On a stress test approach of a sensitivity analysis that would capture extreme events beyond the averaging at the 2030 and 2070 points.
Yeah, let me check on that. I think there is some whether I want to use the word guidance or a requirement. I'm not completely familiar with that part of it, so I'll need to check on that and get back to you.
Hi, I apologize, I haven't actually read the technical reference or looked for this information, but under emergency response, is there any guidance for how to deal with a value that has a low recurrence probability? So for example, emergency response post-catastrophic earthquake, maybe 1 in 30 year, immensely valuable when it's there, but not a recurrent value on an every year basis. Is there any guidance for valuing that?
Yeah, it's very similar to flood damage. It's very rare occurrences, but huge value when it does occur. And so the process that we, you know, one of the methods that we suggest is to do that kind of analysis. You would certainly need to consider the recurrence interval or the you know, exceedance probability, or using that same kind of approach of that actually happening. So you don't assume for your benefits that it's occurring every year. And in terms of data on which to base that, you know, whatever the best information you have that's relevant to you, to the service area that's going to be receiving that benefit.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess more drilled down, what I heard is you had prescribed dollar value for water supply by regions. Is there a similar thing? What's the value of an acre foot of water on hand after an earthquake?
Oh, we haven't provided an example unit value for emergency response specifically. Just some methods. Yes.
I heard you say in your example of monetizing these benefits that you need also to monetize costs, but then it was losses.
Mm-hmm. Impacts.
Then it was confusing that everything you showed was a gain. So, in fact, while you add the 4 boat ramps, you also lost 8 raft put-ins on the river that's now flooded.
That's
and you
correct.
Lost the spawning ground. So, really, all of those things need to be monetized and put into the equation. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Hi, so I have a couple of overarching questions about the monetizing of the benefits, and this is just based on the examples you provided in the summary tables that you put up, you know, earlier this week. The types of examples you provided about, say, there's an overemphasis, maybe not an emphasis overly so, but on salmon, right? Lots of the relative environmental values and the unit costs you provided are for protection of salmon or improvement for salmon. And similarly, some of the water supply benefit categories you've listed are end of, you know, May and a September, October storage or something like that, that are typical metrics for existing facilities meeting existing requirements upstream for protection of salmon or flood control, right? And my question is, how do you expect projects, and so this just really implies an underlying assumption that somehow a new project that is not existing will contribute to the benefits that, you know, those projects, those public benefits, those existing projects currently afford. And so there's a question, it's kind of like an indirect benefit, right? So if my project backs water up into Shasta, but my project has no way of providing, say, benefits to salmonids, right? So Los Vaqueros is obviously in the Delta, not necessarily going to provide temperature improvement in spawning areas. And so, but lots of the examples and lots of the information you provided are potentially not direct benefits and not necessarily within a project's control to ensure that those benefits are received. You know, so even if my project does back water up into Shasta, you know, the ability for me to control how that water is then used for those projects, you know, is difficult, and we have run into it in the past, you know, where requiring reoperation of other folks' facilities without, you know, is outside of the purview of my project and my authority. And so I'm just wondering if you could speak a little bit about the expectation, you know, about direct benefits that I can control and guarantee in terms of these monitoring contracts in the future that will be required, you know, as we go forward, versus the monetization of maybe indirect, you know, increased system flexibility and things like that.
Yeah, I'll respond about the scope of over which you estimate your benefits, and we want you to calculate all of those changes wherever they occur in the system if they're related to the addition and operation of your project. So when it says, you know, end of September storage or whatever it said. That would not just include your project. I mean, that would include the changes that your project has allowed or induced throughout the system, including other reservoir changes in storage, and you would demonstrate that through the analysis that you provide. And it would also include groundwater storage if your project is being conjunctively used or has some other effect on stored groundwater. The other part of your question, I think, was how, if you don't control the operations of those other affected reservoirs, how are those benefits sort of guaranteed and counted? I think that gets to the question of how, you know, more generally, how are these agreements for and plans for managing benefits system-wide, because they may be occurring system-wide. And that's probably out of my purview.
So I'll try and address your question just a little bit. I mean, speaking to your broader question, improvement to the state water system is one of the requirements of the statute, and it's something that the commission is very interested in. And so I think you will see that reflected in the regulations and the evaluation criteria. You know, we recognize that, I think there's sort of two parts. You know, we also recognize that you can't necessarily guarantee the provision of a benefit that is quantified in your application because things change. And so I think the contracts for administration of benefits are going to become very important, and so those are not included in the regulations currently, but that is something that we are looking to address. So,
thanks. I just wanted to kind of, anyway, maybe I'm belaboring it too much, but, you know, so if a multitude of projects that are applying are, you know, so something like a unit cost of salmon, $100,000 per fish, is, you know, can have the potential to really increase the benefits, you know, the cost-benefit ratio of any individual project. And if those are all essentially, if everybody can apply, everybody who's applying can basically look at the system reoperations through CalSIM and the tools you're providing and claim those benefits, you know, you're not going to have, when you're evaluating it, right, in terms of selecting your projects, you're going to have potentially a multitude of projects that are claiming essentially this indirect benefit that are kind of, you know, it's not going to... Anyway, just those things to think about as we're going through the technical reference document in terms of if everyone is able to claim an indirect $100,000 per fish benefit to, you know, really get the score they need. You know, anyway, those are sorts of things that have plagued, you know, the unit cost of fish project stuff in the past. So... anyway, hopefully we can work it out so that we have sensible things at the end of the day to, that won't undermine, you know, the state's investment choices. So, thanks.
Yeah, I think by necessity, the commission is having to look at these projects one by one as they come in, and there's been some discussion among the at commission meetings as to, you know, when we pick a set of projects, can we look at how they all work together, whether there's time, you know, in the to do that, or ability, willingness to do that, I don't know. But so at this point, the process that's laid out is a one project at a time, with and without that project, what are the changes?
Yeah. Getting back to the emergency question,
yes.
It sounds like a dedicated storage is not required for the emergency benefit, but that you would be able to evaluate the supply of water that could be provided, and then net out what the use of that water would otherwise be to determine what the net for
that's,
the emergency.
That's right. Yeah, no, we're not requiring that you set aside a portion of your reservoir storage for emergency supply per se. But if you're claiming it as a benefit, there's, you know, we have some assumptions that you can use on how often it might be. You know, it depends on the kind of emergency, obviously. And then you would need to evaluate what you give up in terms of the other benefits that you would have gotten from that water, but you, now you don't because you've released it for Delta control or whatever. Yeah.
Steve, I have a couple of questions. The first one is, how have the lessons learned from the recent drought influenced the approach to monetizing benefits? I noticed in the technical reference documents you have dollars per acre foot in 2030 and in 2070. I'm curious, how has this recent drought influenced the calculation of those numbers?
Well, we've included in our data set for that, we've included some information from 2015 and, as you know, as much as we could. We think we got pretty much all of it from 2014, at least what's publicly available. So that information has weighed into the analysis. It's not, you know, it doesn't determine the analysis because those were like the worst years many of us can remember since 77. So, you know, it's a statistical analysis, so it's in there, but it doesn't, you know, we're not saying that, as you can tell from the unit values, we're not saying that for now into the future the value of water is going to be, you know, $900 an acre foot or whatever the biggest, you know, sale price was last year.
Yeah, the numbers for that are in there do not reflect what was, if you look at these are in 2015 dollars for
right.
2030.
Yes.
They do not even begin to reflect what the transfer market was doing last year, where $600 an acre foot water was being sold in Sac Valley to export, and down in the San Joaquin, it was into $2,000 an acre foot. So I was surprised to see numbers of 150 to 300 being used, and it just seemed like there may be a disconnect. Anyway, just...
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be a mistake to use the single worst year to determine what the future will hold. We hope it's not going to be like that from now on. If it is, I guess we'll deal with it. But all I can say is, you know, we laid out the method we used, the data set we used, and, you know, this was the, you know, the information that came out. If you look at, you know, the critically dry year for purchases by areas south of Delta, it's a pretty high number. And certainly, you also see that we estimated it with groundwater constrained to a rough estimate of what safe yield might be by region. I don't want to say, you know, claim it's anything more than that. And, you know, the values are quite a bit higher in the Sacramento Valley, I mean, in the San Joaquin Valley because of that.
So the applicant will be allowed to come in with, say, our own data set for supporting a different number than what's in the technical reference document, or are we required?
That's the general rule about the technical reference document, is if you can support a different analysis, you're allowed to do that.
Okay.
It's subject to review.
Yeah. We probably will. Then I had one other question, which is, how are you factoring in the uncertainty in our ability to accurately estimate biological response to water benefits that are contemplated by the state that are then going to be monetized? I see huge uncertainty, and your early charts just showed a nice little dot. And
right.
When we go to compare with and without project, the uncertainty bands can overlap.
Yeah.
How are you planning to analyze an application with such high uncertainty on fish benefits?
We certainly want the applicant to characterize that uncertainty, and it's going to depend a lot on the particular methods that you use. I'm not a fisheries biologist, so that, I mean, I can't speak to, you know, the specific models, but it's a difficult thing to do. In all of these cases, you know, future population and across the board, there's a lot of uncertainty out into the future. So all we ask is that you lay out your methods, provide the information, and characterize the uncertainty as best you can.
One more question, kind of to some of the climate change issues that have been raised, also the uncertainty with some of the ecosystem benefits. I know you guys are preparing the modeling suite at the end of next week, on the 9th, and it would be helpful if you... Going? Okay. So one of the things we've discussed a lot, and I just make the comment again, I'm going to provide it in written comments, is as you roll out the suite of modeling tools, there'll be new information, and a large percentage of the information you're asking applicants to provide about project conditions will be contained within those modeling tools. That's an 82-year hydrologic period with or changes and things like that, you know, the recurrence of, say, when those unit costs would come into play, right? So if you're using the typical method of the Eight River Index, the change in water year types will occur between, you know, the 2030 and the 2070 condition, and as well as the availability for cold water pool storage, you know, some of those metrics that people are used to seeing. And so I hope that I will be able to, my agency will be looking to characterize and summarize some of those results from the modeling tools that you're providing, because we can do that in-house. But I think it would also be useful to everyone if the commission could also publish, you know, some kind of summary or characterization of the modeling tools that they're providing and the assumptions, to provide that background because I'm just one person who's interpreting the model, but it'd be great if you guys could also, you know, similar to the delivery capability report of the State Water Project, you know, where you have a summary or a metric or a change or something like that, just so that everyone in the public can also have an understanding of basically what those existing conditions are, and you're not relying on every individual project to characterize all of that information on an individual basis. Of course, it'll be relevant for each project, but considering you're providing so much of it, that would be really helpful. Thank you.
One over here, and I'll come back to you, sir.
Yeah, and you'll make that comment in writing also. All right, thank you.
Yeah, continuing on this kind of conversation around
the uncertainty that is inherent in a lot of the estimates. Another thing that the commission is already doing, as described in Appendix A, is providing cumulative distribution functions for the precipitation minimum and maximum temperatures for the 2030 and 2070 time points. And given that, you know, it is ending up relying, the process is relying on these kind of snapshots and then a linear trend interpolation, at least providing the distribution functions can allow people to put in some error bars and provide some estimates of uncertainty, at least for those two time points that they're actually reporting back on. And it seems like you'll be doing that work anyway. Why not provide that information?
I think I'll let Daria Samir respond to that. She's been working on that.
Thanks. So the precip and temperature, projected temperature and precip changes that you mentioned, they actually, they come out of global climate models. Then there's a regional downscaling. Then we analyze two different emission scenarios. Altogether, there's a 20 model scenario combination. So were you suggesting that we put out the precip and temperature changes? For informative purposes, you mean? Because otherwise, I mean, when you talked about the bars, for the error bars, that would be a very significant effort to carry that uncertainty through the analysis. That's what I was trying to explain. The analysis itself is very complex. I mean, sure, we can give the CDFs that we have based on those, and that will give some information. But I'm not sure. Right, but there's so much involved in, you know, after we obtain our data, then we run the VIC model. You know, there's so much, so many steps in the way. It's almost impossible to propagate that error and sort of end up with an error term. That is why, usually, we use a comparative analysis, right? But if you like the information, sure, I don't see why we cannot provide it. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Yes. See if I can correct in understanding that the contributions to, by the entities need not be monetary contributions. If they could be assets with evaluation to be contributing to the project. And the second part of the question is, did the legislation allow greater flexibility over the 50% on the part of the public benefit contribution where it involved the reoperation of a reservoir?
Yeah, there is a provision that allows greater than 50% public contribution for certain kinds of projects. And I, my recollection is reoperation is included in that, yes. The first part of your question was, could an applicant provide existing assets as part of its cost share? In other words, could the 50% be judged relative to some contribution of existing assets? Was that what you were asking?
Yes. Let's say there was a need for additional land for recreational purposes. Uh-huh. An entity could contribute land to meet the requirement as opposed to having to find cash to contribute to the calculation.
I'm not in a position to make a policy call on that, but I believe in past grant programs that has been allowed. I that's all I can say, in, you know, right now, I think that would be a, need to be a higher staff level decision. But my position would be that that's, you know, that's a legitimate contribution, whether it's in cash or not, and the market value of that land would be, could be part of the contribution. But I can't make that promise right now.
Any additional questions?
Well, I keep anticipating like one more question, but so if you do end up with one, interrupt me, or you're welcome to come up and talk to staff offline after the meeting. I just want to thank you all for being here and for your really great questions. As Chris mentioned, if your question was not answered satisfactorily today, we will be providing written responses to the questions from this meeting and all of our TR briefings on our website following the meeting. So keep an eye out for those. Our formal public comment period will start on September 2nd, so I look forward to all of your written comments. I want to thank you all for being here. Thank you to Commission, State Board, and DFW staff. And with that, I will close the meeting. Thank you.